Hey everybody, thanks for tuning in to today's episode of Real Talk. It's Lucas here, and I hope that today's episode informs and inspires you to have your own real conversations. As always, today's episode is brought to you by our friends over at Trivan, maker of trucks, trailers, and enclosure buildings tailored to your needs. Be sure to check them out at trivan.com. A huge thanks to them for sponsoring the show and making it possible. One other quick note before we get into today's episode is that if you are willing and able, if you could leave a review, preferably a five-star one, on any of the podcast networks or platforms that allow for it, such as Spotify or Apple Podcasts, that will be much appreciated as it helps get the word out there and lets people know what we're all about. So, with that in mind, on to the episode. Welcome, everybody, to today's episode of the Real Talk Podcast. Today, I'm joined, honored to be joined on the show by Reverend Dr. Sam Andreadas. I still mess up the last name. I tried so hard.
That was pretty good. That last one. That was pretty good.
Okay. We'll get there. I'll call you. If you don't mind, if I call you Pastor Sam? Is that okay?
Sure.
Okay. Sure. Okay. Right on. We'll go with that. That saves me the embarrassment of trying to nail that last name every time. So Pastor Sam comes to us from PCA Church down in Pennsylvania, and I'll give you a little more of his bio in a minute, but he's written a book called Across the Kitchen Table, Talking About Trans with Your Team, which is, it's just a short little book, not a super long read, but I would definitely recommend it for anybody, obviously any parents looking to get a handle on this issue, and especially if it's a live issue in your family circle or your circle of friends, you know, people who have kids struggling through this issue, or just people you know. It's becoming more and more of a prevalent issue in our society, and one that we need to be able to respond to well in a Christian manner. And we've discussed the issue of transgenderism on the podcast before. I think most recently we had some fellows on here from ARPA up here in Canada. ARPA is a reformed political action group who does political lobbying and whatnot. So we talked about it more from a legal and a political perspective, but of course, you're addressing this more from a church perspective, from a family perspective, and what it actually means in terms of boots on the ground. Like if your child is dealing with this, or somebody you know or love is dealing with feelings of not being right in their own body, and feelings of being transgender. So just to give our listeners a quick bio on Pastor Sam here. He's been a minister in the Presbyterian Church in America for over 20 years, pastoring churches in New York City and rural Pennsylvania. In 2008, he founded Higher Ground, which is a ministry of Christian discipleship, serving those with unwanted same-sex attraction. Pastor Sam has also authored several books designed to help people build a theology of gender, and he has counseled scores of couples on marriage and relationships, as well as giving numerous seminars across the country on the gift of gender as presented by the Bible. His wife of 33 years, Mary Kay, and he have raised 4 children. So thank you for joining us, Pastor Sam. I think first off, just to get into this topic, you start at the beginning of the book with a bit of a flow chart, breaking down the reasons somebody would consider themselves to be transgender or thinking about becoming transgender. Can you kind of walk us through what that flow chart is and how you kind of came to breaking this issue down in such a nice way, a nice format that way?
Sure, Luke, I'd love to. And I appreciate your bringing in initially saying this is not a long book. It's something you can read easily, because people tend to feel overwhelmed, and I wanted to present something that would be practical, but go deep very quickly and help people get the real big pieces of the puzzle of what's in front of them when they have a family member or a child and decide that they're one of these letters, they're trans in some way or another. So that's the idea of the book. It's not something that can be as heavy, is too much to read. You can get through it, but it really does give you the kind of main pieces of the puzzle. And the first piece, as you're bringing out, is how do you tell what the person is saying? Trans is a big umbrella of a term these days. It could mean many different things. So I just did a flowchart in the beginning to say, hey, what box might we be standing in? And I go through these. I'll mention them kind of briefly. The first is if you're talking to a teenager who is saying, I'm trans or I'm queer non-binary, what it could be, first of all, these days is simply a desire to fit in. All of us have a desire to fit in, but for teens, it's visceral. It's so important to be understood and accepted in one's peer group. And if it's become fashionable in your neighborhood to go trans, they just might not want to miss out. And if that's where you're at, if it's really just what they call rapid onset gender dysphoria, which in actually when you get right down to it, isn't really a gender dysphoria at all. It's a kind of wanting to be cool with one's peers. Then, the solution is the same. I tell parents from time immemorial, it's to realize that the teenage years are a battle for the heart of your child. And even as we read in the book of Proverbs over and over again, the father is saying, go with my counsel, don't go with these peers that are going to take you in a different direction. And it's a pleading, it's a reasoning, it's a reaching out. And so that's like a big category. But if it's not that, if it's something really serious, then the next thing to look for is what I call the lurking comorbidity, because these days trans is likely to be, given as the problem, rather than a symptom of something that might be a deeper disorder. And if your family member is in this box or boat, you probably realize it because you've been living with them. But there are associations, and this is well known in the field, there are associations with transgenderism or gender dysphoric feelings that are very prevalent. Autism, certain anxiety disorders are very often associated with this. And to deal with these kinds of more serious problems, we need usually a multi-tiered approach, multi-pronged. Certainly you want to have some sort of counseling, specific counseling for it, perhaps medication, definitely spirituality and applying the powerful truths of the gospel. The third box, if there's not a more serious problem, is true body alienation. And there's a need there to be reconciled with the body and to understand gender, which is most of what my book is about. There's a fourth box I have, and that is activism. Sometimes people will identify this label because they are seriously concerned with what they identify as an oppressed group, and they want to stand with their friends and stand against bullying. And that's something to applaud. If we find that in our close one, our loved one, our teen, we want to make sure that they know that's a good thing. And then it's a matter of hopefully showing them some truths to help them how to really help vulnerable outsiders. There's another box that I include. People don't tend to think of it because it's not really allowed to be talked about in the media, but it's cross-dressing for sexual arousal. The term for it is autogynephilia. Blanchard was the guy who came up with that term. And, that means, most adult men who do cross-dress are cross-dressing for that reason. So it's good to be aware of it as another category. And so the book, all total is about the big principles that will help in all of these cases, but especially the third one.
For sure. That's certainly the most prevalent, I think. Before we dive into this a little further, I was just looking at the outline of your book here, and it's of course divided into three sections, three B's: body, breath, and battles. Before we kind of get into each one of those, do you want to just explain to us a bit why you set up the structure of your book in that way? And yeah, basically.
Yeah. And I want to say also, Luke, it's really great to be on your podcast here. I have a great love for Canada. I really love moose. I don't know
Thank you.
how much moose you have in Ontario, but
More up north, definitely.
more up north, yeah.
Yeah.
Typical American ignorance here, thinking about other countries, but it's a real privilege to be up there. I don't know how, maybe we could talk a little bit about the conditions there and how different they are in the States from in
Sure.
Canada. I know that this issue in America is really so prevalent that, what I say on the book is, coming to a relationship near you, because you will encounter this phenomenon in America for sure, based on the statistics. And I imagine it's similar up north as well.
That is true. Yeah, it's if not further up here, at least from a legal perspective too. We have the letter, the name of the bill escapes me right now, but effectively there was a federal bill passed probably about 2 years ago now that effectively for pastors such as yourself, if you were pastoring up here in Canada, you are not allowed to counsel people away from their preferred gender expression or sexuality, right? So, for example, if someone was heterosexual, but sorry, it's only one direction. So, if you're heterosexual and you want a homosexual, and you went to a pastor and for whatever reason, they're like, yeah, you could totally do that. That would be fine. But to go the other direction, or same thing with transgender, to go against what they want, basically, is it's illegal in the country. People still, it's like it is done. But technically on the books, like that law is there, and I'm sure at some point soon it's going to be tested.
Yeah, that's it's not as far along here in the United States. There's a lot of different pressures in that direction, but for most states, it's not like that. Some states are like that. And certainly, the federal government at this point would like it to go there, but has not been able to muster the political will to do that, which is a real shame because it's actually up in Canada that some excellent research was done early on where the doctors that really could help people and were helping people were in I think it was Ontario, but the Canadian practices were excellent before this wave hit for helping people with actual gender dysphoria. So it's a real shame as to where things are now. And but that kind of answers that question of why the book is structured this way. There is a final section I call Battle, which is sort of trying to understand some of the cultural trends that bring us to this point. But the first two parts of the book are just grouped that way to help us comprehend that there are really two parts to this problem. One is being reconciled to one's body, and what are the issues. And the puzzle pieces, as I say in the book, are that surround that. But the other part of it is developing a real vision for gender. That's something that's sorely lacking, not only in the culture, but also in the church. It's like the church has kind of participated in this to somewhat by minimizing gender and not seeing it as the gift that God has given us, not recognizing it in the scriptures. And not, boldly proclaiming it with our lives and our own relationships. So it's those two different pieces that I'm trying to address in those two different parts of the book. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that does make sense. That's helpful. And I think just to start us off here, so when I was reading your book, I think I was kind of struck by the fact that this is not a new issue, and in our culture, this is kind of a repeat of something we've seen historically in the past, which was definitely new to me. Like I think mentally I had an idea of, okay, I'm sure there's always been a certain level of transgenderism in a given culture, but probably not to the extent we've seen it in today's day and age. But you do list a number of biblical examples of this issue rearing its head throughout time and history. So, do you want to provide some of those for us and lay out some of the context of this issue historically?
Sure, I appreciate your bringing that up because I get asked that. Like I was at a doing a conference, and I got the question, How can the Bible really speak to us on this issue when, this wasn't even really appreciated in biblical times? Like the biblical writers didn't understand transgenderism or what we understand about people today. And I thought that that person really didn't quite grasp the historical context of well, didn't have a good grasp of history, really. And we could get clues from the Bible writers themselves. Paul implies in Romans 1, the breakdown of gender occurs in any people that leave off th thanking God. And that's, he kind of implies that in Genesis 1 in relationship. But even in the Old Testament, which hails from sometime in the second millennium BC, whatever your dating preference, second millennium, we have Deuteronomy 22 forbidding the Israelites from cross-dressing. So you got to wonder, if the prohibition is there, why would it be there unless the temptation is there in the surrounding culture? And it turns out the temptation was there. I mean, you can go back even farther to the third millennium BC. And in the book, I treat Inanna, the great ancient goddess of Uruk, and her adoring princess or priestess princess, and Hedwana, who was from nearby Ur. And Hedwana, was praying to her god in Ur, but it didn't quite bring the results that she wanted. So she turned to Uruk and Inanna and started writing prayers to her. And this is a very influential woman. She's sometimes recognized as the first poet. And she wrote these long prayers, which were influential for hundreds of years. And I actually include a plating, an etching, carving of Inanna in all her glory from the third millennium BC. And you can see just from the portrayal of her, she kind of mixes up. Yeah, there it is. She's about mixing up male and female, and especially in the writings, it's quite clear that she's into this. And so if you were somebody who were not happy being a man, wanted to be a woman, or where a woman wanted to be a man, you could appeal to her for the transition. And she was her and Hedwana's poems were repeated and prayed for hundreds of years. So this has always been a theme of paganism. It's always been present, the breakdown of the gender binary, even if they didn't use the same words that we would use. It's been there. And as our culture continues its steady march toward paganism, we can expect it to be there and to grow. So I think that to think that, well, we're understanding of something about people that they didn't understand back then, that's just chronocentrism. It's kind of this hubris that we figured out something about people that they didn't understand back there. Evidence doesn't warrant that.
Okay, that's helpful to kind of get that historical context. This is a little off the beaten path here, but I'm curious if you have any thoughts as to why, when a civilization rather, sorry, goes away from God, do they also start to abandon gender and the gender differences? Like, is it because we're straying from our creator and the structure and the rule he has given us, and it's kind of inevitable in that way?
I would say it's along those lines. If we follow Romans 1, point I try to make with people, when Paul, people always focus on Romans 1 and say, there, Paul is calling homosexuality a sin. But if you read it closely, homosexuality is not the inciting problem. Homosexuality is the consequence. The inciting problem that draws the wrath of God and the judgment of God is refusing to give him thanks. It's to leave off giving thanks to God, acknowledging him for his gifts. That's what really separates people and sets them down a wrong path, we would say. And so what you have there is a kind of indication that when you depart from God, when a culture rejects God and goes in another direction, then his great gifts of foundational to creation start to deteriorate. And so you would get the deterioration of gender, and what it means to be human, to be really made in his image, of which gender is a part.
For sure. Okay, then in that line of thinking, how should we understand our bodies in biblical terms? Like what does the Bible have to say about our bodies, and compare that maybe to like ancient Greek culture and what our current day, modern day culture says about our bodies?
Yeah, that's a key question. That's good. That's really good because we really do find ourselves to be in contradistinction to our culture here, where nowadays the body is an accessory, sort of like your iPhone skin. You could change it, not really change the phone. Or in trans, it's you, we constantly hear who you are is all on the inside. You determine who you are by yourself because it's all something that's just inside of you. It's not accessible to anyone else. It's not, we don't need help from anyone else. Or even in the transhumanism movement, the idea, the dream of transhumanism is that we could upload our consciousness until some better tech came along and we could maybe get a better body, then download our consciousness and we'd still be us. Well, in the Bible's view, that's impossible. You could never do that because our bodies are who we are. We're very much who our bodies are. We're ensouled bodies. It's only when God breathes breath, the breath of life into Adam's body, that the man becomes a living soul. It's only in assuming a human body that Jesus Christ could save us, all of who we are. And it's only Christianity that stresses bodily resurrection from the dead as our destiny, as our fate. And so it's a great tragedy to experience such alienation from our bodies that the gender dysphoric feel. That's a great tragedy because we very much are our bodies. We could never like separate and say, okay, well, if we upload our consciousness, that's still us. I know there's a lot of science fiction stories these days that go in that direction, but according to the Christian view, you are very much who your body is. That's a big part of who you are, how we know ourselves. Our bodies are signs to the shape of our hidden souls. So this is in contrast to the culture, and that's an important piece of the puzzle if we're talking to somebody who is trans or wants to go trans, is to recognize, just so you understand, Bible says something very different about who we are. And it's helpful.
And it says something much more positive too, right? You have a creator. He gave you this body. He gave you this body for a reason. And it goes together with your whole essence, your soul, right? Like you said, it's going to be resurrected. Okay, that's
Yeah, and
helpful.
we have problems with our bodies. We all have problems with our bodies, but there's so much to enjoy about what God has made, and so much to celebrate. And it's really sad when people can't celebrate that about themselves.
So, okay, that's perfect. That ties in nicely with the idea of shame. So we see when Adam and Eve fall into sin, all of a sudden they realize they're naked and they're ashamed of their bodies. In the book, you tie that in with this idea of body dysmorphia and how a lot of trans people feel that they just don't feel right in their bodies. They feel like they're in the wrong body. So how does the concept of the shame and the fall into sin relate to body dysmorphia?
Yeah, so I find it really helps to take people back to where problems with our bodies began. And that would be in Genesis 2 and 3. So if you remember back then there, Luke, you remember the last thing that this is what I ask people, what's the last thing that we learn about God's world when he created it before the fall? The last thing it says, do you remember?
It was good, I believe.
That's actually not the last thing. That's what we tend to think of because he calls everything good. But the last thing at the end of Genesis 2 that he says is that they were, you want to try again?
Well, he created them and then he rests on the seventh day. And then, oh man, I'm gonna look bad here, but I'm blanking. Fill me in here. I'm learning.
It's not something we think of, but the last thing in this perfect world he's created is that The man and his wife were naked and were not ashamed. That's the
Yeah,
last
okay.
thing we're told.
Yeah.
And then begins Genesis 3 and the story of the great tragic fall of humanity. So that's the last thing before the fall, is they were naked and they were unashamed. The first thing after fall, what's the first thing, if you recall, they feel after they take the forbidden fruit?
Is shame, I think. Like, right?
The
Hey,
first,
yeah.
they knew they were naked and they go and they sew these fig leaves, right, to try to cover it up. So if you think about that, there's great import to that. The last thing they felt, the last thing we're told, is that they were naked, they were unashamed. The first thing after they disobey God is great shame. And that's because they took onto themselves, this is what it means to fall. They took onto themselves the prerogative, the place of deciding what is good and evil, what is right, what is wrong, what is good, what is ugly. And so taking on the good, the true, the beautiful, on themselves as the arbiters of their own morality, no longer are they looking at themselves as icons of God, as made in the image of God. Now they're looking at themselves apart from God. And when you do that, just you and your mirror by yourself don't tell you true. Even the movie stars that have near perfect bodies, perfect looks, they still feel this shame. You can tell in interviews when it's talked about. I give some examples of that in the book. And one of them is a Canadian star, Keanu Reeves, I believe. Yeah.
Yep.
So, and you could tell that in their interviews. So all of us sort of suffer from this alienation from our bodies. And that shame comes from that step of turning away from God. And knowing that's very helpful, because then we know that the way to address that shame, the first step, is to turn back for God's provision for that shame.
Okay, that's helpful. So I think later on in the book you talk about trauma and how a lot of people have shame from past childhood trauma and various events that have gone on in their childhood. And then I guess my question of that related to that is, do you think people often, and this is probably subconscious if that is the case, do they go down the path of pursuing a transgender identity due to this shame they experience from past trauma? And if that is the case, how do we deal with that as Christians? Like, what can we do as the church to help them work through that and to kind of back things up and see the path there?
Yeah, very good. Well, the short answer is yes. It kind of makes sense, right? If you're distressed with your body, there's probably something that fuels that kind of self-hatred, since this is part of who you are. And it's hard to think about. It's hard to go back to for people if this is in their background, but it very often is some kind of childhood abuse. It could be, God forbid, sexual abuse or physical abuse. But there are other kinds of trauma as well. We call them ACEs, or adverse children's experiences. And it could be something like a parent's divorce, or a drug addiction in the family, or an incarceration, or the death of a close family member, or even something like frequent moving. But these don't have to make deep scars, but they can. And they can inspire a desire to get out of your body, to have a different body. It is often some kind of trauma. And so to recognize that really, really helps. It helps you so that you're not thinking, well, this is the thing. No, this is the symptom of the thing. And these really hard experiences have exacerbated that shame that we all feel, but the gender dysphoric feel it especially intensely. And so we can address it, because with a trusted counselor or friend, to go back to those things, to those very hard to face experiences where we have been wronged, and it's part and parcel of our response to that wrong. Go back to that point, and with the Holy Spirit, understand God's perspective on us, on what happened, on how we were wronged, and how we responded to that wrong. Like, there's one woman, she experienced abuse as a child. And she, you know, going back there, she can remember that moment when she decided, I will never be hurt again like this. I will never be hurt. I'll never be in this position again. And so what made sense to her, you know, in her thinking was, you know, I'll be a man, because in her thinking, men are not vulnerable. They're not ones who need protection. They're the ones who are, you know, in the place of power. And a lot of times that is the case. So she said that's, you know, that was what started her down that pathway, is to say, I'm not going to be vulnerable anymore. And it just seemed, from where she's standing, men are the ones who are not vulnerable. And so she would be a man. So a lot of times how it works.
Yeah, it's important to see like the positive side of what the Christian view, the biblical view has to offer, right? Like you talk about it in the book there on, I think it's page 51, just about how the world's response to this is to paper over their trauma and to just go with what the person wants, which is to be, you know, the opposite gender or whatnot. But this does nothing to solve the root issue. And you can see it in the stats, right? They're, trans people are very unhappy people. They have like an abnormally high rate of suicide. And it is by no means a solution to the problems they face originally. So that's it's very helpful to hear. You talk even a bit.
There is not, you know, it's good to point that out. There really is no good longitudinal evidence that these measures that people take, the cuttings and the chemicals, really address people's well-being. Like, it doesn't really diminish suicide rate. There's no study that can really show that. In fact, it kind of even points to one study in Sweden that was done that on every person in Sweden, kind of points to the other conclusion that it actually kind of eventually makes things worse. Now, it takes a few years to get there, but it's important for people to know that. And it's really sad because, especially if you have someone that you really love, you can understand they're looking for something. They're looking for some solution. And unless, I mean, it's very difficult to face our past sometimes, very difficult. And unless you can do it in a place of love, then it's better to try to do a medical solution. It seems like it, you know?
Well, at least, yeah, on the mental side of things, well, obviously I think there's probably a lifetime of scarring to a certain degree. You can recover, but yeah, once you go and make some of these physical changes, there are lifelong consequences, which we've seen from more and more people nowadays coming out as detransitioners, right? And showing a lot of regret. And yeah, it's tough to see, but I think as you make the case in the book, like, we're going to be dealing with this more and more and more in the church circles. We're going to have a lot of people coming out of this trans movement, like, broken, hurt, and looking for answers. And that's, I think, in part of the reason probably why you wrote this book, is for to help us get a handle on this issue, so we can know how to help these people and how to bring them into the church and make them living members of the body of Christ, right?
Absolutely.
And you can build off that in a second. I had one eyebrow raising thing when I was reading this book, is that you talked about doing an exorcism on page 53 there. Can you share a little bit about what that was like exactly? That's a pretty unique experience.
Yeah, you know, that does raise some eyebrows in Reformed circles.
That's true.
It's like people don't really think about it. But again, I think as our culture continues this steady march toward paganism, you're just going to see more of that. It's more of this kind of activity. But, you know, it is true. The supernatural realm is real. The spiritual forces are there. And although Christ has seriously bound them, where his gospel goes forth, they are bound like a strong man, they do appear and they are there. And I did have this one, there are a couple instances that I've done this more than once, but I just talk about one in the book that specifically had to do with this guy who was trans. And he wasn't in my church, but he came over from another part of the city. This is when I was pastoring in New York. And he kind of laid out his history for me, and it was clear to both of us, it was very especially clear to him, that there was a demonic presence that had come in through this pathway that he was on. And so I took, measures to safeguard. I really didn't want to, just cast out a spirit and say, see you later, because unless the guy was really, I think, in the process of change, he would end up, Jesus said, in some situations, you can cast out a spirit, he goes and then ends up getting seven more spirits worse than himself, and the guy's worse than he starts. And so this guy was really understanding the gospel, and I made sure that he understood what it was really about, which was Christ dying and setting him free from his life and his sins. And he understood his own heart before God. He understood the need for Christ, and he was receiving that. And that was the change that was going on for him. So, I enacted just safeguards of counsel, good counsel, and made sure that he understood what was going on. And then, yeah, I did cast a spirit out. It was somewhat dramatic, in his just kind of manifesting things coming out. But then, yeah, he began his walk in manhood that day. And the last time I spoke with him, he was in, he was very much a man, very much in good shape.
Good. Okay, that's remarkable. Glad to hear it. Okay, so returning back to more the topic at hand there on transgenderism, you gave a couple good biblical examples of when people in the Bible who didn't know their true selves or didn't know what they were capable of, and the comparison obviously with trans people is just yeah the true self and not knowing who they are exactly. A couple of these examples are Gideon and Jeremiah. Do you want to touch on those for that and kind of flesh those out?
Sure. Well, yeah, there are a lot of examples. When people encounter God in the Bible, it always often begins with an argument about identity, about who they are. And that's certainly true, for example, in Gideon, who is, not the picture of courage. He's beating out the grain, threshing out the grain in the wine press. He's hiding from the Midianites. So he's not exactly Mr. Brave there. But the angel comes down, sits next to him, and says, "Oh, mighty man of valor." And then ensues this kind of discussion about who Gideon really is. Gideon's like, "Oh, no. And, that's not me. I'm the least of my people, the least of my tribe." And God is trying to redefine him, redefine his identity. And that, that's an argument. That's an argument that people have to have with God, and hopefully allow him to triumph, to trump their idea of themselves and take on his idea of themselves. And Jeremiah is another one where he doesn't think he can talk, and God takes him back to the womb. He kind of precludes what Jeremiah might say, which is, "I was born this way. So if I was born this way, this is the way I am." And God actually says to him, "Actually, I was there. I was there when you were born. I was there before you were born. I was there when you were being knit together in the womb. And I'm the one who made you. So let me tell you, I make people talk. I'm the one who made you. I'm the one who determined your identity." And that kind of hard word is there for you when you encounter God. It's important for people to see that, so that folks today who are encountering God and finding a contradiction of their own view of themselves can understand they're not alone. Like, this is not a strange experience to have God come and tell us, you think you're one thing. Like, maybe you have a female body, but you think you're a guy. You think you should be a guy. I have a different idea of you, and I've expressed that idea in creating you with your body, or vice versa. You're a guy and you think that you want to be a woman. This is the way it is with God. When we encounter him, he starts by redefining us. That's an important piece.
Yep, that makes sense. And we have to trust him because he is God. He is perfect, and our desires can very much be wrong. They have, as you talk about a bit later in the book, our desires have a moral weight, right? And we can certainly think we are one thing and be absolutely wrong. In that line of thinking that you talk about, in the book of James, he has what you've called a pregnancy model of temptation. Can you explain how that model works and how that relates to the topic at hand?
Yeah, thanks. That's another piece, to talk about how responsible are we for our desires? Because, in this country, for example, there's a movement called Revoice, which kind of skirts this issue about our desires and tries to say, well, we might have these desires, but they're part of who we are. And we need to acknowledge those desires. Maybe we're not going to act on them. Even there are some Christian believers who say we have these desires, but we're gay Christians. We're not going to act on them. We're going to try not to act on them. And I bring up James and his model because he helps us see that when we are going to engage in something that is not God's will, it's not something that just happens like that. There's a gestation period to it. And it has to do with our desires and whether we come into union with our desires. So James actually pictures it in terms of pregnancy in his letter. He says, there's this time when our desires come out and we decide whether to identify with them, to come into union with them, to become one flesh with them. If we do, then that there's a conception in a way, and there's a gestation of that in us. And then when it comes to fruition, full term, so to speak, then it gives birth to sin. And that helps us to see that we don't just wake up and sin. There's a gestation period inside of us that happens, and it is very much what we're responsible for is not just the end result. What we're responsible for in the beginning is to call out the direction of our desires. All our desires have some direction. Either they're taking us in the direction of God's covenantal promises and the way in which He tells us to live our lives to flourish, or it's taking us away from them. And we have to call out the direction of those desires. And then it's very important once we do that to not to come into union with them, to not to say, this is who I am. I spend time helping people with unwanted attractions. And it's very important for them to be able to not identify with their desires, to say, this is not who I am. Because if we come into union with them, we've already lost. And so James helps us to see that we want to be able to say, this is not part of who I am, and Christ allows us to do that. And I've seen guys get victory over that, but it starts with being able to say, no, this is not me. This is something else that might be inside of me, but it's not me.
Okay, let me try to summarize this to see if I understand it. So we have thoughts, words, actions. Thoughts being kind of analogous, the same as like desires in this situation. On this side of heaven, we are simple, imperfect beings, so we are going to have those desires to a varying degree. So let's say the desire is a same-sex attraction. We have to say this is not our identity. This is not my identity. And then if you can do that, that will help you not come into union with that identity, that thought, that desire, and then it will not become words, and then it will not become actions. And then if you could repeat that cycle long enough, you will ideally, with the grace of God and living a life walking his word and his ways, you will have less and less of those initial thoughts and desires. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, that's pretty good. I think, we have to acknowledge some of the things that I was talking about before. Like there may be healing that needs to take place and appreciation of what God has done in us and appreciation of our gifts that, so it's not the whole picture, but what you're saying is true, that this is an important part of it. And how we respond to those desires early on.
Okay, that's helpful. Okay, so I want to move on to gender, because we've obviously transgender is the topic at hand of this book. But I think underlying that, of course, we need to discuss what the biblical view of gender is. Our culture has a view of gender, although that's kind of becoming more and more blurred and harder to understand, because
Yes, it is.
we move into a bit of a gender bending time, right? But I think as Christians, broadly, we probably hold to a more traditional view of gender, in terms of our cultural standpoint. But maybe sometimes that traditional view does not always align with the biblical view. So I guess the question, my main question, is how do we separate stereotypes and archetypes, as you talk about in the book, and how do we hold on to some good archetypes, and even maybe potentially even some good stereotypes, well, and not giving it to the world while still not holding on to the ones that are incorrect or unbiblical and harmful to the people we're trying to help, who are most affected by this issue.
Yeah, well, that's a great question. And it has an easy answer, actually. And it's one of the principles of gender. And that is to always understand gender matters in relationship. You see, Luke, the way I would say it is we don't want a traditional view of gender because that's inadequate. What we want is a biblical view of gender. So we want to stay very close to the scriptures in understanding gender. And so the Christian view of gender is actually a big issue. It's a big deal. Like I go around this country, I do seminars on building a theology of gender or the gift of gender. And I usually, and I, take a weekend, we do seven principles of gender to help people kind of build up an alternative to the cultural offering. And that's what we want. I feel like if we stay close to the scriptures on it and not really kind of adopt the cultural stereotypes, then we're in a much better position to deal with any of these things that
Could
come down the pipe.
we take a practical example of this that you mentioned in the book? So on page 83 there, you talk about boys who wear nail polish, right? So you have the three reactions. You have the eruption reaction, like, what kind of foolishness is this? This is lunacy. Take this stuff off right now and clean your fingers off, right? The cool number two, the cool reaction, which is like, oh, that's really neat. That's how you show your style. Good for you. Who says it's just for girls? Like, you tell Charlie, that sort of thing. And then number three,
You
which,
can
yeah.
tell these are different kinds of parents.
Oh, very much, very much. And then number three is the Christian reaction. So, like, you list here, male nail painting is a new trend. That can mean different things. I'd like to hear your thoughts on what it means to you. They affect our presentation of ourselves. We craft an image. So when I was reading this, I guess, like, I think I agree with you, but also, like, I could for sure see myself in the number one camp. Like, maybe not a complete eruption, but like, I guess if I were to defend the number one reaction there, I would say the parent means well in that they clearly, or they understand it to be the case that this trend we see in today's culture of men painting their nails is driven by a culture that is deliberately trying to bend the mores around gender and is contributing to this movement away from the standards that God has set out for us, the archetypes. So I think that would be, I don't know if every parent would articulate it as such, but I think that would just be like the gist underlying that. So I'm not saying people should yell at their, whatever, go off the
Well,
rails
they
on this.
all of them mean well. All of them are meaning well. But I would say, let's just say you are a parent And you say that to your kid, and your kid says, "Okay, Luke, Dad, I'm sorry, Dad. Where in the Bible does it tell me not to paint my nails because I'm a man?"
Yeah, then I would say there is no particular passage. However, there are cultural norms. You can do it, but why are you doing it? And let's look at the reasons why you are doing
Okay, well, that sounds like you're number three then.
it. Yeah, I know. But I would start with number one and then I get to number three because I don't, because I would understand that as like, yeah, don't paint your nails. That's like you're
Okay,
doing it because you're
I
following a cultural
understand
trend.
that.
You see
I
that?
understand that, and I would have the same maybe reaction inside, but what you'll find as a parent is, especially a parent with teens, is that it's very important to get to where they are thinking and what they're thinking before you get to maybe what the best thing is. And that's very important, because if you're a teen and you feel like your parent is not listening to you and they just have their thing, and it's not even something in the Bible, it's just their thing, then you tend to shut down, and it doesn't move the relationship forward. You know what I mean?
That's fair. I'm 25. I have a 9-month-old daughter, so I'm not
Ah,
that.
congratulations. That's
Yeah, thank
great.
you. Thank you. Yeah. So
Well, you don't have to worry about this for another 11 years.
yeah, I got a little bit of time, but I'm not that far removed from my teenagers. So you know what? Upon reflection, I see the value of what you're saying there. I guess I wanted to go into that for anybody who reads this book to say like yeah, emotionally I feel the number one answer, but intellectually, I agree. I think it's probably wiser to take a number three approach there.
Well, you'll find as a parent, there are emotions that we have that sometimes don't help the situation, and we have to not go with those emotions, even if they're there.
That's true across the board. I think marriage, work,
Now,
anywhere.
let me tell you, there's a guy that I really respect. He's in ministry. He himself has, a struggle with same-sex attraction, but he's a real overcomer. Like, he is committed to the Lord. He's a great disciple of Christ. He ministers in this area. And I just have a lot of admiration for him. And he painted his nail with certain things on the nails. And when he went out, he would go out and minister and talk to people about raising support for his ministry. He did it that way so that it would start a conversation. So people would ask, "What is that on your nails?" And then he had a little thing that he would go through based on what was on his nails. So is that the best thing? Probably not the best presentation for everybody, but I thought it was pretty interesting, and in some cases really effective. He was out there, and this guy is no, I have no suspicion or doubt about his commitment to the Lord and his orthodoxy and his walk with the Lord. So that's why it's good to at least find out what people are thinking.
Yep, that's fair. The intent is very important there.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, okay, so building off this then, you talk about it in the book as well. What does it mean to be a Christian man? And then in relation, of course, what does it mean to be a Christian woman? How do we understand these two the two sexes and what I would say the two genders? Like it's very important to know that in today's day and age.
Yeah. Well, that's what I try to do in my first book, is build a definition. And that book is called Engendered. And I'll tell you what I come to in that work. A man, a real man, is someone who consistently and with joy lays down his life for the close women in his life. He ties himself to their growth, through taking charge for them, through securing them, and through finding God's purpose in their relationship. And a woman, a true woman, is one who consistently and with joy advances the close men in her life. She ties herself to their promotion through granting them authority, through giving them rest, and through divinely empowering their mission together. So those are the definitions I would argue from the scriptures.
Okay, we could. I like those, and I think I trust your judgment and your research on that. We could delve into those deeper, but I think for the sake of time, we'll leave that there, and that we might have to have a separate discussion in the future, either on men and women or even on the topic of dating too. I know you've written on that as well, which I think would make for an interesting episode too.
Well, it comes in really, it's a really important point about dating. That's when men and women also, it's important to know what they are. Gender is a big part of dating if you're going to do it, if you're going to do it well, I would say.
Okay. How about let's close it out here. We'll skip over the scientific trends and let people check that out in the book if they'd like to, closer to the end of the book. But I think fundamentally the key question I want to discuss with you and want to leave our listeners on is how can the church be ready to help people, transgender people, and in particular those who are detransitioning, coming out of it, or seeing the other side who are looking for help. And like I mentioned earlier, we'll probably be looking for answers in a place like the church. How can we be ready to help these people and lead them to Christ?
Well, God bless you, Luke, for asking that question. You know, I wish that more of us would be asking that question because it's coming, you know, as I say on the book cover, you know, it's coming to a relationship near you. We need to appreciate what is coming. I think it's similar to Canada, but I know in the US, you know, in 2007, there was one pediatric clinic. One in the whole country, pediatric gender clinic. I'm sorry, I don't mean pediatric clinic, but pediatric gender, specifically gender clinic. And today, there are hundreds, hundreds. In fact, we can't even count them because Planned Parenthood jumped in to the game, and so all of their clinics double as pediatric gender clinics, and they're dispensing centers for hormones. So we don't know how many there are, but there are hundreds. And that means we don't know how many children have been put on puberty blockers because they're not really recording it. But what we do know is invariably, if someone is put on puberty blockers, they invariably go to cross-gender hormones. It doesn't really put them on pause. It puts them on a track to go towards this path of taking cross-gender hormones for life. And so we can't even judge the number, but it's big. And in the US also, there are close to 200 colleges, including all of those in the Ivy League, who now have they cover gender imitative hormones and surgeries as part of their student health insurance plans. That's a lot of colleges. And so they're encouraging folks in this direction. And in over half the states, Medicaid covers transgender related health care. So when, after several years, which is how long it takes, all these people realize that it hasn't really helped them, they are going to be looking for other answers. They're going to be showing up in church. So we will be witnessing a legion of maimed bodies with an ocean of regret there. And so the church has a real call here and a real choice, I think. We could try to ignore them and say, well, this doesn't have to do with my life and hope it goes away. Or we could recognize something about Jesus, and that is, Jesus uses people in their area of struggle to bring forth needed truth for his people. I mean, in Moses, God sent a stutterer to teach the church. You know, God wanted to form a people, and so he gave all three patriarchs wives who could not have children. That's the way he works. So their repentance and faith of these people coming who will be coming are valuable. And so we have to see them as valuable. They're li very likely needed. They're a gift to the church. So we that should inspire us to roll out the red carpet and be asking these questions now. Are we welcoming to people who've made decisions that we wouldn't agree with in the past, but whom Christ is drawing? The spirit is drawing in. Can we speak in a welcoming way to those who have begun questioning their paths? Do we have we thought out a good bathroom policy to provide a safe and welcoming, safe place, but also a welcoming place in this new reality? Are we helping our people to imagine what it's like to have a trans person, next to them, and how they can respond with Christ's attitude? Those are the things I would bring up to think about.
Yep. It's important to understand, right? You got to understand the issue. I would encourage people again, pick up a copy of Across the Kitchen Table, talk about trans with your teen, so they can learn more. It just caught my mind there on the last point there on the bathroom policy. Do you? I don't want to put you on the spot, but do you have a specific recommendation for how a church should deal with that? Because that's a really thorny issue.
No, I think it's fair to put me on the spot. I'm the one saying we should do it, so I should have thought about it. I've tried in the different churches that I've pastored, the last two churches that I pastored, I tried to say, hey, let's look at our facilities and see if there is a way to make it both safe to address the safety concerns, because we really don't want to have men in a woman's bathroom, right? That's not safe. But at the same time, can we do it to somebody who is really thinking about their lives and questioning their lives to make them comfortable? If they're still in a place where they're trying to imitate the opposite gender. One of the best ways, if it's possible, is to provide a single-use bathroom. And also, what we're thinking about now in our current church, we're kind of thinking this through, but to have women who are especially trained to be recognizing a situation and being able to diffuse a situation and make recommendations there, and then summon help if it's necessary, or to just really monitor. So there's a process of monitoring a bathroom that can go on, or also providing single use bath, single, single person bathrooms, if that's feasible.
Like a universal washroom for handicap or whatever. Yeah, I know at least here in Ontario, a lot of buildings, any new builds would have to have that for a church for sure. And a lot of older ones are doing retrofits and whatnot too. So, yeah, I know that's kind of my line of work too. I own a door supply company with Tyler, the co-host of this podcast too. So we do a bunch of that kind of stuff, but that's
Oh,
just
see,
an
that's
aside.
good. So what do you mean a church has to do that? Why does a church have to do that if they were building?
For accessibility reasons, often they'll make you put one in. So like
But
someone with a
specifically for trans accessibility or other handicapped or stuff?
hey, just wheelchair accessibility at this time. Yeah. But it the way you suggested it kind of serves a dual purpose that way. So that's interesting.
Yeah, I think that sounds like a good and helpful way to address this in one way. Would you agree with that?
I think so. Yeah, I think so. I wouldn't it's got to be every church has to make their own decision on that. Like, are you gonna spend the extra money to put an extra unit in there or an extra washroom? But that's probably a decent way to do it. And I like the idea of having people who are trained to keep an eye on the situation. Because yeah, like as we're talking about, okay, if we're gonna see more and more trans people or formerly trans people coming back into a church setting or into a church setting for the first time. You want to you on the one hand, yes, you do want to welcome them and share the gospel. On the other hand, you can't be unwise, right? So having people who can keep an eye on things, I think that's a good balance you struck there. But that's even just that, right? Having more trans people in a church setting, it's going to take time for people to get comfortable with that because it's inherently an uncomfortable thing to see. Like I've been out in public. You see people, like a change room setting in a store, And you're like, okay, like, how do I deal with this? And as a guy, I'm just like, oh, it's a bit uncomfortable, but I'm not scared. But I know for other women in life, like, it's legitimately like a concern, right? So it's one of these things we have to really get a handle on and be aware of on the danger side of things, but also try to be as open and welcoming as we reasonably can in a church setting too.
Yeah, it's like being around tax collectors and prostitutes, you know.
Okay, that's
We
fair.
don't feel like it. We don't feel like it, but Jesus has other priorities.
That's a good comparison. I like that. Okay, well, let's end it off there. Thank you, Pastor Andreatis, for your time. Really appreciate
Very
it.
good.
Thank you, thank you. And do you want to plug any websites or other books or people places people can find you online?
Well, Luke, I want to say you've been very gracious, and I appreciate your giving me a platform here, an audience to talk about these things. I feel like they're very important, and the church needs to think about them. So it's been great just spending some time thinking about them with you. I would say if people want more information, they can just go to the website. My website is affirminggender.com. That's one word, affirminggender.com. And I post there pretty regularly on these issues, and the books are there for people to look find out more information about. That's probably the best way to kind of get more information this way.
Wonderful. Okay. Well, thank you very much again for your time. Thank you to our listeners for tuning into today's show. Feel free to send us your feedback if you have any questions or concerns. We can always follow up and provide some answers at a later date in future episodes. So with that, yeah, we'll leave it there. Keep having real talk, and we'll catch you next time.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Real Talk. We really appreciate you taking the time to listen or watch the show. If you want to send us your feedback, and we'd love to hear it, please email us at reformedrealtalk@gmail.com. If you want to find us online or social media, we got a lot of great content there. Just search Reformed Real Talk and we should come right up. This show is created and produced by myself, Lucas Holtfluer, and Tyler Vanderwood, and our wonderful podcast manager who does all the editing is Mariah Tamaga. So we're really thankful for her contribution to the show as well. That's all for now, folks. Thanks for watching or listening, and we'll catch you next time. Bye-bye.